Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Capella University is rethinking higher education. With their game-changing FlexPath format, you can earn your degree on your schedule, so you can fit education seamlessly into your life. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Candace Owens. If you don't know Candace Owens, you're going to get to know Candace Owens in the next hour, because she is just fantastic. She angers many people, and that's why I like her. First, I'll tell you about Tommy John. Push yourself. I always say, jump in that cold pool. Do another 10 minutes on that rowing machine, but not to discomfort. Do not seek that, especially when it comes to the underwear. And that's where Tommy John comes in. Real comfort with Tommy John. Start every morning in Tommy John underwear. I do. When you do that, you're just better at everything you do, especially if you're going for a walk or jog or bike ride or something like that. Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have converts. I am wearing mine. Which ones am I wearing? I'm wearing black ones right now. Wearing mine right now. I will not leave. I'll not go out of town without packing Tommy John's. I won't walk out of the house without them. They're that good. And like I said, you'll just convert to Tommy John. Over 96%. 4-star plus reviews and over 12 million pairs sold. Best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free. Guarantee, right, Dawson?
Get that much more comfortable at TommyJohn.com/Adam and save 20% on your first order. Save 20% right now at TommyJohn.com/Adam. TommyJohn.com/Adam.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Candace Owens' Birthday Cocktail Party for April 29th. Let's see who's here. Duke Ellington is here, and he took the A train. Uma Thurman. Jay Cutler. Drainage Eli. Daniel Day-Lewis is here, and he will drink your milkshake. Hey, it's Andre Agassi. Michelle Pfeiffer. And Jerry Seinfeld. Russian Tsar. Alexander the Liberator. William Randolph Hearst. The 124th Emperor of Japan, Hirohito. Fraudster and financier, Bernie Madoff. And blue eyes crying in the rain, Willie Nelson. Candace Owens is on the Adam Carolla Show.
Wow, what a birthday you celebrate.
Incredible birthday cocktail party. I mean, Willie Nelson. I mean, that's Uma Thurman. That's a solid. I didn't even know those people had the same birthday as me.
You may be the leader in the clubhouse. The book, by the way, Blackout, How Black America Can Make Its Second Escape from the Democrat Plantation. It's available now on Amazon. It's been out for a while. I'm a big fan of Candace. Of course, No Prager, you've done some videos on Candace's show as well. So good to see you, my dear.
Thanks for having me.
So for you, I think people know who you are. They know your name. Obviously, you rub a lot of people the wrong way. I think the way you rub a lot of people the wrong way, I do the same thing, which is you sort of state the truth, you back it up with a few statistics, and then you don't apologize, and then they get apoplectic about it. I don't get it. Once you state your facts and then you back it up with data, then why are you allowed to be so angry at you or at me?
I think what it really is that we're in this sort of outrage culture era. The thing about outrage culture is the only way it's able to sustain itself is if people acquiesce and apologize to the outrage. You know, oh, I'm sorry, you guys are all outraged, so therefore I will issue some bland apology that I don't really mean, because I just want you guys to be less outraged. And me in particular, I tend to find the outrage to be hilarious. Like people think if more blue check marks or more people say it, then it must be true, which is obviously a fallacy. And yeah, if you're stating the truth, you're stating the truth. So I get that you might be outraged at the timing of the truth, but I'm not sure like what the right time is for the truth to make an entrance. So I'm just perpetually in trouble with, particularly with the left, but in general.
Do you find Prager always suggests that the conservatives are a happier group of people? And it's interesting because a lot of the stuff I grew up with, and I grew up with very progressive people out in Southern California, we were poor, but my family's very progressive. And rich people were always described, or I shouldn't say rich people, I should say conservatives. They're always kind of described as super uptight, no sense of humor, very easily offended, kind of God-fearing, you know, pearl-clutching types. And even if they're the facade, the appearance of their family was a happy, well-put-together family, behind the scenes, there was alcoholism and rage and anger. And I always just kind of bought into it. And as I got a little bit older, I started hanging around with some conservatives. And I started spending time with your Dennis Pragers and your Ben Shapiros and folks like that. And I realized, oh, they're in generally a better mood and seem to be even more upbeat and actually seem to laugh a little more. You're Larry Elder, so I know you're a fan of, who's been on this show many times, and Dave Rubin and guys like that. And I went, these guys are actually the funnier, easier going, friendlier group.
Right. And that is true. So the media is very good at creating a caricature of any person individually, but especially of what conservatism is. They've been rock solid on, you know, creating that caricature that you just described. And because they've had so much power before, I think, social media, they were able to sort of sustain that image of the old, stale, uptight, can't laugh at anything. That's what the Republican Party represents. And that's what conservatives represent. And I think there's been a shift, and that shift is largely due to social media, where you're actually seeing that, wait, actually none of that was true. These people have better values. And because we don't take ourselves as seriously as the left can't laugh at anything because they're offended by everything. Everything offends them. People are starting to gravitate towards conservatives and realize that we do have a bit more fun, a lot more fun. We don't take ourselves so seriously. And we realize that humor and making fun of each other is actually a way for human beings to connect. You need that. You should be making jokes. That's kind of that is what connects us as human beings.
Well, you know, I'm thinking, to be fair, there's a kind of a math, which is, most comedians and most satirists and the lion's share of the famous stand-ups and, you know, comedic writers and actors are left-leaning people. So if you took the cast of Saturday Night Live or you took the top 20 stand-up comedians working, 19 of them would be considered left-leaning and so on and so forth, your favorite TV shows. You know, Norman Lear created many funny, iconic TV shows, and he's a very left-leaning individual. So it, in a way, I think there's a little extrapolation. Like people are saying, well, Dave Chappelle is left-leaning, and he's super funny. So maybe they have the market cornered on the sense of humor, on a sense of humor. But I don't think it works that way in terms of numbers, but it is interesting that a small group does create the comedy and is on the left.
But the thing is that Dave Chappelle thinks he's left-leaning, but he's not, because he can't survive in what the left has become. And we've seen this drastic change in what liberalism, what leftism, whatever it is you want to call it, particularly, I would say it's catalyzed over these last 6 years. Where they take everything deadly serious, where they're literally trying to cancel comedians for telling jokes. And so I did this experiment where I went back it wasn't an experiment. I just sometimes like to go back and watch old stand-up comedians because they're very funny. And I watched Chris Rock's Bigger and Blacker, which I recommend everybody should do this. Just go back and watch it. And this was just a blockbuster stand-up act, which was absolutely hilarious from beginning to end. And I am watching it now and I'm going, oh my God, this could never exist.
Right.
He goes right in. He starts making jokes about race. He starts calling black people out for their flaws, white people out, like, you know, black people and the culture of baby mama. He starts going after white people. He's like, if it's a school shooter, it's a white guy. You know what I mean? Like, and saying all these things, and the room is on fire. People are laughing and he's made fun of every race that you could possibly make fun of. And by the end of it, everyone feels better, right? Because it's like, this is funny and it's hilarious and we all feel closer and it sort of unites us in our humanity, like, and almost in our fallibility. But now the left has sort of become this idea that any blemish is enough to cancel anyone forever. So they're digging up tweets from 20 years ago. Imagine not being able to have any growth from 20 years ago. I mean, I fortunately, Twitter didn't happen until I was leaving high school. So I was allowed to grow up, be a jerk, make mistakes. Well, now they're sort of peddling towards this culture and this idea that you need to be perfect from the time you're 4 years old. And that's a scary place to be. And comedians cannot exist under that sort of pressure.
Well, let's talk about your trajectory and how you became who you are today and where you started. I've heard dribs and drabs about your upbringing and college years and epiphanies and awakenings, but I'd like to just start at the start and go back with you, Candace. So you're born where and what kind of family system?
I was born in White Plains, New York, and raised in Stamford, Connecticut. And my family, my immediate family, was very poor. So me and my sisters lived in a tiny little apartment with my brother and my parents. So six of us, the three of us shared a bedroom. You know, there were roaches, fist fights. I talk about a lot of this in the first chapter of my book because the media sort of created this caricature of me as some girl that grew up wealthy because I vote Republican. So therefore, and I'm from Connecticut, and I guess everybody in Connecticut's a billionaire. Right. And so I grew up poor. And when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my grandparents, who were more middle class, came to our apartment and were just like, we just don't want our grandchildren to grow up like this. And they moved us into their home. So all nine of us lived squished in this more middle class home. So squished. My parents lived in the basement. Me and my sister lived in the attic type squished.
Wow.
And my grandfather just had a totally different system of how things should run. So he'd get up early in the morning, 5 a.m., make us breakfast, and we'd have to read the Bible, you know. And it's sort of, I call that chapter in my book sort of the early seeds of conservatism, because he was planting those seeds without me being aware or assigning it to a political doctrine or anything. It was just, he believed in structure. He believed in my brother had to go out and do yard work. He expected us to be young ladies and we had to go to church and, you know, dresses, he'd pull out doors. So he sort of, my grandparents is who I attribute a lot of my conservative beliefs in now, because that was the something that was right in my life that I didn't realize at the time. I thought they were, you know, God forbid you go to school, you hit this, you know, when you secularize yourself and you go, okay, if I want to be cool, you can't say that you read the Bible in the morning, right? That's not cool. So that was sort of my start. And then when I moved out of their house when we were in high school, my parents moved us back to a bad side of town. And I just wanted to sort of erase that part of my life. And I became much more, secular is really the right word. And I went through a very tragic experience in high school, which was classified as a hate crime. And I was die cast as a victim, and the perpetrators were die cast as racists. It was essentially a situation, and I go over this whole thing in my book, because the left has taken that story from me. Kids who left a extremely racist series of voicemails.
You're in high school at this point?
Yeah.
I'm in high school.
Junior, senior year of high school.
Senior year.
Yeah, I'm a senior in high school. And you know, the irony of this is I didn't know three of the kids who had done it. I had never laid eyes on the fourth kid I knew. And he used to be a very, like a very best friend of mine. It was really a very juvenile situation that got blown out of proportion. I stopped being friends with him. He went out and had his first beer. He was obviously hurt because I had a new boyfriend and I was, you know, being a typical girl and hang out with my boyfriend every second. He gets drunk with these kids and they decide to leave me these horrifically racist voicemails because he's trying to hurt me, right? And if you are a 16-year-old kid and you are trying to hurt someone and you think of what is the absolute worst thing I can say to a black person, it's going to be something racist. So these voicemails were, we're going to put a bullet in the back of your head like Martin Luther King. Like, we're going to kill you like we did to Rosa Parks. We're going to tar and feather your family. I mean, really bad stuff. The irony being one of the kids in the car was a Democrat governor of Connecticut's son.
Oh, boy.
yeah, well, now, so that's this, what made it.
This boy sounds like, I mean, if I, I'm picturing myself at 16, sounds like he had a crush on you, I'm guessing.
People assumed that at the time, but he's now out of the closet. And I, at the time, knew, like, you know, that this was not a kid that was interested in women. And I think he genuinely was just emotionally torn up because I went from hanging every single day of every second we were spending time together to me hanging out with none of my friends because I got my first boyfriend and that was it. Like, it's so juvenile in the retrospect. But at the time, it became this massive narrative because the governor's son was involved. So it was politicized. And they instantly blew things up in true politician form rather than the governor coming out and saying, my kid was there that night. He did it. He tried to cover it up and say, we need the FBI to analyze the voicemails. I mean, the FBI had to get involved and he knew his kid had done it. And, you know, it took 6 weeks, an FBI investigation and all of this crazy stuff. Newspapers covered it every second of every day because, you know, it's like, wow, we have this scandal going on. It was racialized. The NAACP was meeting me outside of my high school. I mean, just imagine this. I went from somebody that nobody knows to suddenly being diecast as a victim and being told by the NAACP, they're marching next to me. Irony being, they never spoke to me before the cameras were there and never spoke to me after. So this is about them fundraising because another black girl went through something. And I was too young to understand that at the time. And these kids were cast as racist. Like, you know, that's it. They're done the rest of their lives. And nobody thought to stop and just maybe do the adult thing, right? So you got the politicians, the organizations trying to fundraise, the news channels, like victim narrative, villain. And nobody thought to just stop and say, these are kids. I would have been fine with an apology. I didn't need these four kids to get arrested. I didn't even report it. My teacher reported the incident. And it sort of completely shaped. It killed us all four of the kids involved and myself, because I felt like I had a narrative created for me. And I was like horrified that people saw me as a victim. And for them, I know they went on to have multiple arrests, DUIs. I mean, they just were able to ravage children. And the second they were arrested, everyone went away. And it was like, none of us, they didn't care. It was just a moment for the media to create and to make money. And that experience would later on, after 4 years of anorexia, trying to properly put what had happened to me into perspective, shape all of my ideas, would really shape my opinions about the media, about race issues, and realizing how obsessed us as a society have become with race issues, and about the dehumanization of people and the inability for people to allow people to grow when they make a mistake.
Right. Yeah, you had a front row seat, and not only a front row seat, you had like a peek behind the curtain of how the apparatus works. And so you're sort of uniquely qualified to get a glimpse at that at such a young age when many people and even most go through their whole life without having any idea of what is actually really going on the other side of that curtain. And it's so interesting when you talk.
I saw the Wizard of Oz. I saw the old guy kind of orchestrating everything.
It's 16 or 17, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't at that time, again, it took me a long time to realize it because, like I said, I was so torn up about it and ashamed of it. You know, it just, I was so worried of meeting new people and Google and see these articles, and there it is, victim, 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 victim. And it didn't feel good to be a victim, right? And I'm sure for them, it didn't feel good to be a villain. And I didn't feel good about the fact that they had, you know, turned this kid into an avowed racist. He was my best friend. He couldn't have been a little bit of thinking there. He was my best friend. He couldn't have been an avowed racist. So he was reacting emotionally as a child and said some horrible things and rounded up some people to say some horrible things. And he should have been, you know, obviously he should have been in trouble for that. Not like, you know, saying that was a great thing to do, but the obsession with sticking a label on someone so early and what that does to them is something that I became very interested in, the psychology of that down the line.
Well, I've heard you speak about it. I've spoken about it many times. I'm coming from, you know, old heterosexual white guy perspective, so no one wants to hear what I have to say. You're probably coming from a perspective that even though you're black, they want to hear what you have to say less than me because you're not saying the right thing. Right. Turning someone into a victim is about the worst thing you can do to a human being, period, flat out. When you have a child and the child is a special needs child, confined to a wheelchair or what have you, the worst piece of parenting you can do is convince that child they're a victim. We all understand that universally, speaking of comedians, Brad Williams, he's a funny comedian. He's a little person. He's outgoing. He's successful. He drives himself all over the place. He travels. He does everything. He's independent. And he chalks it up to, I think his father, I'm trying to think of it, the stepfather, his father said, "You're not a victim. I'm not going to take stuff off the upper shelf and give it to you because you can't reach it. You got to figure out a way to get the mug off the upper shelf if you want a cup of coffee." And he always brings up his dad sort of saying to him, "I don't care if you're 3 foot tall. You're not a victim. Go figure it out." And he is now robust. He has a zest for life. And he certainly doesn't look at himself as a victim and has a great sense of humor about what a lot of people may think is a disability. So we all get that when you're dealing with Brad Williams as a young person, his father did the exact right thing, which is don't make him into a victim. I famously had my daughter tell me she didn't make the volleyball team 4 years ago because the coach hated her and I didn't want her to be a victim. So I explained to her it's about ability. She's going to have to work harder, blah, blah, blah. I'll support her in that. Do not think the coach hates you. The coach wants to win. They want the best players on the team. You didn't do enough to impress the coach. She's now made the varsity team or the highfalutin team and has never felt better about herself. If I had joined in with her chorus of victimhood of, "Oh, the coach hates you, I'm going to write him a nasty letter and find you a coach who loves you," then I don't think she would have had the success she's having today. So turning an individual into a victim is the worst thing you can do for an individual, and turning a group into victims is the worst thing you can do for groups. Why? We think this is somehow, there's some humanity in this. Somehow we're going to treat the black populace as victims because we're good people. That's the part where it goes into that's when it gets insane, because now not only are you doing the worst thing you can do for a group of people, but you're wanting praise for it, and you're calling the people who don't want you to do that to that group of people bigots. This is upside down world. Thoughts, Candace Owen?
Well, so really what you see is everybody can be a victim. Everybody is a victim. There's no point. I mean, obviously right now, if I dug into things that have happened to you at some point in your life, you're a victim. Everybody at some point is a victim, and they will be victimized over and over again because that's sort of like life, right? The point is what you're talking about is trying to keep somebody as a victim, as like a prolonged, this is it forever. This bad thing happened to you, and now you get to carry this around forever. And the truth is that becomes a weight. So for me, I sort of entered that next period of my life and I saw myself as a victim. I believed in that perspective. And it ruined me. It absolutely ruined me. You know, I became an angry, bitter, woe is me. Everything's happening to me. It's all because of this thing that happened in high school. Anorexia. I wasn't a good person is the best way to describe it, because I had been handed this excuse You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This happened to you, and therefore you now have an excuse to be a bad person. You have an excuse now, and if you get a C, it's because of this horrible thing that happened to you. If you fail a class, it's because this horrible thing that happened to you, and the world doesn't understand what it's like being you, somebody who was victimized by the color of your skin. And, you know, eventually, and it was because of my grandmother's death, which was untimely and unexpected, I just woke up one day after her death and said, this is not who I am. This shouldn't be my world perspective. The world isn't happening to me. I'm happening to the world. And her sudden death changed my life because I thought to myself, here's a woman, my grandmother, who lived years of her life in a hospital, was considered a crippled, you know, never, ever complained about anything. Here she is married to my grandfather, who grew up on a sharecropping farm, who had a job since he was 5 years old, who dealt with the real KKK and grew up in a segregated America. And he has never, ever had an excuse about anything. They were like such amazing, incredible people. I dedicated my book to my grandparents. Never heard my grandfather say a bad word about a white person. He would just, if you ask him today, it was just a different time. And remarkably had such a great relationship with the white people that owned the sharecropping farm that he grew up on, that when he retired, he purchased that sharecropping farm from the family and he now owns it today. So I was ashamed of myself for falling for this poison of victimhood when I have grown up in a society where I never had to lay tobacco out to dry like my granddad did at 5 years old. I did not grow up in a segregated society. I did not, in my opinion, yes, what was said to me was racist, but I knew the person who had done this was not a racist. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? And so that shame, which is a necessary ingredient, we're trying too hard to remove shame from people's life, led to a massive transformation and everything got, it was like being free out of prison. Like I didn't know I was in prison for 4 years and suddenly they're like, you're out, you're good. You can go live your life as you want to. And I realized I didn't have to be a black girl or just, you know, a victim and all of these things, these labels that you're supposed to, this is how you need to think. And I got to be Candace Owens as I was raised. I had got to be Candace Owens who could envision a future and decide what I wanted to do and didn't see all of these barriers everywhere because of my skin color, because of my gender. And it was, you know, it was the best part of my life. And I'm still living that today.
How much effect are you feeling from people like you and the aforementioned Larry Elder? And but just a kind of a growing group of black commentators, sometimes even comedians, sometimes athletes, you know, your Herschel Walkers and people just kind of piping up, like things are being said that weren't formally said, probably thought but not said. You know, people are sharing their opinions. It feels like there's a bit of a groundswell in this direction. Now, in my opinion, CNN is never going to do this, and politicians aren't going to do it for you either. Certainly no one on the left. It's going to take black politicians who are saying, like, you know, enough is enough, like what's going on in Baltimore. It's going to take, you know, it's funny. It's like, it's so crazy. When Trump said, hey, black community, what do you have to lose? And CNN was apoplectic. I was like, that is the truest thing that anyone has ever uttered. He's saying, what do you have to lose? Look what's going on in your communities. How could it get worse than that? And everyone went nuts. It's so funny. When you utter the truth, they go berserk. So, but it feels like there's a groundswell here. It feels like there's more than there was 5 years ago. I don't know what, if you have numbers, I don't know if you have statistics or just thoughts or feelings.
Absolutely there is. And you can see that, by the way, why they're harping so hard on the race narrative now is because they've lost their grip. They're losing their grip on Black America. And, you know, I take full credit for leading a new generation of Black conservatives. What I mean by that is, you know, I've stood on the shoulders of giants. Larry Elder is a mentor to me. Thomas Sowell informed my entire perspective once I was ready to hear the truth. Walter Williams. And because of those people, I am able to exist. If they didn't write those things and I didn't have someone to turn to that was willing to just keep taking all of these bullets, Candace Owens wouldn't be here. But when I got into this, I realized that what they were getting wrong, and I said this to Dr. Ben Carson, I met him in his office once, and he said, "Man, you've been able to accomplish more in 2 years than I've in my entire career have been able to accomplish in terms of the conversation in Black America." Obviously, he's way smarter and more accomplished than me. He's just a brain surgeon. But what I said to him was, "You were too polite. You, Dr. Condoleezza Rice, you were all just too polite. You know, if they were called coons or Uncle Toms, they sort of just took it, you know, and, you know, they're too educated. They're not going to respond. And they just sort of gracefully continued in their pursuit for truth. But we're a bit different. We're fighting back and we're not afraid to have a spat with someone like Cardi B, like I had, you know, a few weeks ago, where I'm calling out Jay-Z and Beyonce. I'm calling out LeBron James. This was unfathomable 5 years ago, right? There was this concept that culture was king and queen. LeBron James literally referred to as a king. Beyonce literally referred to as a queen. So you just do as they say, and nobody has the audacity to dare say anything counter to them. And we've sort of taken that agency back and said, who the heck are you? You know, LeBron James, great. You're talented. You're a beast on the court. But you're not one of the intellectual leaders of our time. And so I think what you're seeing a shift in is an attitude that's catching on in Black America, where it's like, wait a second, who are you to tell me what to think? And when you start getting to the point that we've disintegrated so far that now Cardi B is telling us who we should vote for, right? I mean, that's really a problem, right? Then, it's actually good for us because it allows us to sort of like take back some of that turf that we lost in past generations of Black conservatism.
I have a couple theories. I'm curious your thoughts on them. One is, it seems to me to really be effective and really kind of turn the ship around that it's not going to be about converting Blacks to conservatism. It's going to be about taking Blacks and whites who are liberals and saying, you really think this is the plan? Like, you really think this is going to work? Like, do you really think if more young Black boys are being suspended from junior high, do you think not suspending any more Black children from junior high is going to fix a discipline problem? Or might we approach it from a slightly more scientific standpoint than that? So my feeling is sort of like, hey, all my liberal pals who literally love Black people, like they like most the liberals in Hollywood and comedians and folks I know, they like Black people more than they like white people. Look, if you don't believe me, if you said to them, who is the top person you'd like to go to? Who's the couple you'd like to go to dinner with? It would be Obama, Michelle, and Barack Obama, 100% in Hollywood. So if it's great affection, great love for these people. When are you going to start really thinking about these policies that don't work? Why right. are you voting against school choice? Why mm-hmm. are you voting against school choice? You love these people. You want opportunity for them. Every child deserves a shot at a world-class education. Here is a program that Blacks and Hispanics and all the people you espouse to love overwhelmingly endorse because it helps them, and yet you vote against it. Why don't you start thinking about that? Where's your humanity? Where do you care? And if you do care, why not? Why not school choice?
Well, so you said, why don't you start thinking about that? And I think one of the things that people need to understand, or at least people need to recognize, is that when you're talking about Hollywood, you're not talking about people that think much, right? So the average, you know, prototype of a Hollywood actress or an actor or somebody that reads lines and just repeats what's said to them and very well. And so their heart could be in the right place, but their brain is not. They don't understand these policies. They don't understand the complexities of these policies. Everything is a fad. Everything is about staying relevant. Everything is about feeling good and actually doing good. So you cannot actually think that these Hollywood actors and actresses understand policy. That if you said to them, ask a question that basic, why are you voting against school choice? They would have any idea what school choice was beyond the talking points, beyond the script that's being handed to them by Democrats, right? And right. that is the flaw. And that is why I say, you know, Hollywood, to me, it has become everything the Bible warns against in terms of idolatry, right? These are false idols. girls. And they, like I said, I think they mean well. I don't think Lady Gaga means bad and she wants to destroy Black America when she gets and says, vote for Hillary. Right? I think she thinks she has bought into the script handed to her that women are oppressed. They are not, right? You think she's studying statistics about women versus men and understanding that actually, no, men are actually more oppressed in our society. But she wants to do good. So she's got this passion, you know, to do good, to make other people feel good. She feels like she's broken out. And so the emotionality behind the Hollywood character, a typical Hollywood character, is something that you can't really extract from the occasion, from the equation. So that's what you're seeing, a bunch of dumb people with good hearts trying to affect change.
Yeah, you know, it struck me that in Hollywood, you know, they would say there's nothing they like more than a strong Black woman, but they're picturing Michelle Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Then they hate your guts.
Right.
They hate Candace Owens guts, who is a stronger Black woman, because all Michelle Obama is doing is repeating things that make her more popular. And that group can simultaneously knowingly nod all the stuff that's coming out of her mouth. It drives me nuts when people who are influencers explain, when Michelle Obama explains what a systemically racist society we come from and then gives instances of her being discriminated against, stories like, I went to buy frozen yogurt with my daughters and someone cut in front of me in line. It's like, do you have any idea how often that happens to everyone in the course of a lifetime, white or Black?
It's actually a sign, it's a sign of her privilege that she even brings that up. It's actually a sign of her privilege that she brings that up.
Yes, this thing is like, I have an example of racism. Okay, what is it? I was at a Ben and Jerry's and a white lady went in front of me in line. It's like, your example of racism is something that's happened to everyone who's ever been born?
Right.
That's an
right.
very...
Like somebody,
that's an interesting
somebody
example.
Somebody cut me off while I was driving. So I have lived through racism because a person cut me off while I was driving. But they don't understand that because they actually have on these rose-colored glasses and
they see
everything through the lens of race. Right. And they don't understand. These are actual normal instances that every single person on the planet goes through, but you kind of think you're a special snowflake and you should never have to go through this.
Michelle Obama's got to be like, I went to a McDonald's to order an egg McMuffin at 3:30 in the afternoon and they said they stopped serving at 11. If I was white, what a horribly insidious, dangerous message for you to keep spreading far and wide, you who are married to a man who did two terms as the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The hubris.
And there are people, I use that example often because people will talk about this systemic racism that exists. And I say, do you think that, like, it's just the color of your skin? Yeah, it's just color of your skin. And I say, so you think Sasha and Malia are living through a racist, having a racist, horrible experience? And it's like, well, no, I don't think they are, because there is no such thing as systemic racism. You know, people that are living through various things, there is no such thing as white privilege. In fact, the concept of white privilege is a literal definition of racism, assigning attributes to someone based off the color of their skin, just saying all white people are privileged. I mean, and yet not acknowledging that Malia and Sasha Obama are remarkably privileged, right? And so kind of fostering that conversation, and they can't see it. And it's because there's an entire ecosystem, the media, the politicians, the athletes, that all feed one another in their delusions. And they don't know that they're delusional. They have no idea. And they, like I said, they don't mean bad, but they do bad.
Well, I got a theory. I got to do a spot and a quick break, but I'm going to tease this for you, Candace. The book Blackout, you should know, is available now on Amazon. Here's an interesting thought. I believe there's a group of people, CNN and Jesse Jackson and all these guys, the race hustlers, the usual Al Sharptons, the usual hustlers out there. And they basically, this is a cottage industry for them. They get paid. There's the politicians, there's CNN, and there's Al Sharpton, and they make their money off fomenting this race and this hatred, and the idiots that sell books and the nut jobs who are going to lecture every Fortune 500 company about micro racism and all this nonsense. Okay, there's a group of people that are going to make money off it. Then there's a larger group of Americans who are just scared. They don't want any trouble. They don't want to pipe up. You say Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. I want to finish my meal. I don't want to get into it. I just don't want to be ostracized. I'm scared. I kind of believe all lives matter. I don't want to say it. I don't want to be fired. I don't want to be deplatformed. I don't be whatever. So there's a very large group of people who kind of say I'm down with the cause, but they're not really down with the cause. They're cowards.
Mm-hmm.
As the tide starts to turn, as people like you speak up, as your voices are heard, as politicians start speaking up, as people from the community start speaking up, even athletes and actors, a much larger group of those people who claim to be down with the cause but are actually just operating from fear, they're gonna change fast because they don't really believe it. They're just a large group of scared people who don't want to get called out. Once they see other people sort of coming out, like Scientology, everyone was scared of Scientology, and then people started coming out against Scientology, and then everyone started coming out against Scientology. Do you think, again, I'll tease this, do you think once it happens, or once it starts to happening, or those dominoes start to fall, it's going to fall fast? It's going to fall quickly because of this large group of people who say they're down, but they're really just scared. I'll tease that to you, Candace Owens, and I will tell you first about NetSuite. If you're a business owner and you know, business is tough out there, you may want to make things a little easier, and that's where NetSuite comes in. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down. Stop paying for multiple systems that don't give you the info you need when you need it. Upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. Get visibility and control over financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more all in one place. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, save time, save money, and step up to NetSuite. Right, Dawson?
Join the over 21,000 companies using NetSuite right now, and let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/Adam. Schedule your free product tour now at netsuite.com/Adam, netsuite.com/Adam.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come right back with Candace Owens, and she can think about my theory of people converting fast once more people come out of the closet, so to speak. We'll do that right after this.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all woke, no joke culture, has over 1,000 five-star reviews on Amazon. Here's one.
Adam does again. It's so invaluable, refreshing to know that not everyone out there has completely lost their mind.
Thanks, Ozzy. Pick up I'm Your Emotional Support Animal now. Available in all formats. For more, go to adamcarolla.com.
Well, back with Candace Owens, Blackout, name of the book, available as we speak, wherever you find books. And, of course, the Candace Owens Show, available on PragerU.com and PragerU's YouTube channel as well. So my hypothesis of the large group that thinks they're down, but they're not really down. They're more frightened. And once more people come out, so to speak, they will join them.
So here's what I'm going to say, because I've actually thought a lot about this. And I actually like to take it back to kind of make predictions about what we can expect in the future. So I like that you said it's really a small group of race hustlers. These are the people that are committed, who are making money off of this, and who really insist that the world needs to run this way. And I always go back to Ruby Bridges. I don't know why this is the scene that sort of plays out in my head. I wrote about this in my book, but I go back to Ruby Bridges walking into the elementary school. I think it was called Franz Elementary School, and a bunch of white racists screaming, spitting, yelling at her, saying the N-word because they did not want this school to be integrated, right? Well, here's the thing. The majority of people, not every person in America, felt this passionately. specifically about, you know, school integration. Most people probably thought it was time, that this was wrong. And the people that were sort of existing in the crowd that were yelling and spitting and screaming at her were these committed racists who actually just believed that white people and black people were that different. It took what for people, everyone else, to realize that they had a real issue. It took actual scenes and them realizing this is actually how far this can become. When people were marching across the bridge and they were releasing dogs on black people and black people were being attacked and they're spraying hose. We're now starting, white people are starting to understand what their silence is costing them with this Black Lives Matter stuff. So now you're seeing images of black people harassing white people, which is reminiscent of the 60s when white people harassed black people at restaurants, at cafes, screaming in their faces, demanding allegiance, demanding that they know nothing about these people. And they're threatening them. It's a threatening demeanor to scream in someone's face and to yell. Now white people are seeing that even if you're not racist, and a black person says, I had a bad day, I don't like this person, you can lose all your sponsors. It happened to Lea Michele from Glee. Sounds like she was a really annoying brat to work with, but she never said anything racist. She just wasn't nice to anybody on set. And one black girl said, oh, I hated Lea Michele. And what happened? She lost all her sponsorships. So I think what will naturally happen is now that you're seeing white people are realizing, here's what your silence is actually costing you. Saying, I don't want any drama. I don't want to get involved. It's costing you jobs. It's costing you corporations that are making you go through trainings and insisting that you're racist. Your kids, your offspring cannot survive in a society like this. When having an opinion can deem them racist and being deemed racist, just the accusation of being called racist can ruin their entire lives. So you're going to have to grow a spine. You're going to have to realize that you may be uncomfortable in this moment, but you say nothing and very quickly you're going to wake up one day and you're going to realize that you're in a fully vulnerable position of victimhood. And I try to help white Americans realize that. Technically, I don't have a horse in this race. I'm black, right? So I'm protected by that. But you guys are not. And you're helping build a society where racism is now being reintroduced as some payback because black people who never lived through it are angry and white people that never enacted it are sitting down and taking it.
Do you find it somewhat comical that everybody who disagrees with the left is racist? I find it insulting, but as a comedian, I do find it sort of entertaining. Like every year, somebody is going to run against you and you're going to call them a racist. Someone with no history or policies or anything whatsoever of racism. And somehow they're just going to magically become racist. And you're going to trot that out every single year. You're not going to modify it. You're not going to go, well, we're going to have a hard time with Mitt Romney. I mean, he's not a racist, so we'll save it for the no, we're going with racist. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Everybody who disagrees is a racist.
Yeah, it's funny and it's sad and it's pathetic. And it's actually ushering in an era of black supremacy where it's enough for black people are able to strip power, get book deals, get, you know, promotions, all of these things off of an allegation. I mean, you can literally just I could call you racist. And if I was a liberal, of course, I'm black conservative. So if you know, it doesn't count. But if I was a black liberal and I said, Adam Carolla, I have this racist experience, it could have never happened. And you could lose everything that you own because of the allegation. That's power, right? You want to talk about that. That is real power. And that is being handed to black people, not because of black people, but because of white guilt. And I cannot figure out, Shelby Steele has an excellent book about that. It's called White Guilt. Of talking about what white guilt is actually costing white people. And you got to hit the brakes and really, really think about it. Because you may have been fine, but your offspring, as I said, will not be.
It is, it's a bizarre society that we're crafting and we are crafting it. That's the crazy part. It's not alien overlords that are forcing us into these awkward, insane positions. It's like, this is what we're doing to ourselves. And the people I do believe who are suffering the most, even though it is definitely tough on young heterosexual male whitey, but the black community is just not being helped by this. And I couldn't imagine the, you know, this notion. It always drives me nuts. I don't know why. I've hated celebrities more in the last 3 months than I ever have in my life, I think. But the idea that when Sandra Bullock has to explain that she has to give the talk to her young black adopted kids, or celebrity du jour explains, what was her name from South Africa?
Charlize Theron.
See, like Charlize Theron says irresponsible, asinine things like, hey, there are places in this country I won't bring my black kids. And my answer to that is, name us the city or shut up. You name the city, Charlize Theron, and tell us, or shut up. Because don't do that shit. First off, you guys are flying first class and you're staying at the Four Seasons. I don't think you're in danger in any city. And by the way, if you were in danger in a city, it wouldn't be because of the white man. This would be the wrong city on the wrong side of the tracks. Not because of a guy wearing a MAGA hat.
Right. And it's statistically speaking, the most unsafe place for her black child would be in neighborhoods with other black people.
There. Yeah. Okay. That's the statistics. Well,
yeah,
look.
Right. So if there are places she wouldn't bring them, it's black neighborhoods where her son daughter is most likely to be killed by another black person. And that's the truth that people don't like to talk about.
Yeah. It's a group that never stops quacking and flapping their gums about following the science and data and statistics. Mm-hmm. And yet it's all out the window as soon as you start trying to compare, you know, unarmed black men shot by white cops versus other black young men shot by other black young men in Chicago or Baltimore. I mean, then every statistic, every number, every piece of science goes flying out the window immediately. Right. So obviously they're being disingenuous. But if at the end of the day, you would like to, instead of virtue signal, save a few of those black young boys on those streets or getting shot by other young black boys, there are things you could do, yet they're never discussed. The part where you discuss, you take something like racism, systemic racism, which is such a, if in fact that were true, would be the biggest problem that any society ever faced. You know, if you just went, we live in a land and it's systemically racist, and you'd go, oh my God, that is crippling to a society. How in fact do we address this? And then you never give any solutions as to how we should address this other than give us more money, essentially, is insane. I want to hear some real kind of rubber meets the road reasons. And school choice would be a perfect example of a concrete example of something that could actually help these people. But of course, they're against it.
Stop voting the same politicians into office that have ruined these communities in the first place. You know, stop voting in ideas that the government expansion spells more wealth for Black America when every data points to the exact opposite, and stop operating under the fallacy that Black people can't get ahead because of white people. And I talk about this in my book, it's one of the biggest fallacies that Black people somehow would flourish if you remove white people from the equation. Where? Not in our neighborhoods, all Black neighborhoods. Black people are dying at a tragic rate. Not in the school system. Black students fare better when they're put into classrooms with white students because there's a culture that does not celebrate academic success, right? So it's not in the home. We talk about the breakdown of family and father absence, start looking at those statistics. So why do we operate in this assumption that once you remove white people, Black people will be fine? There's nowhere you can point to where there's proof that points to that idea. So that is what people have a problem with. Going back to, you know, the start of this conversation, is that I tell the truth and I actually believe in equality, right? Equality meaning that I don't believe in white supremacy and I don't believe in Black supremacy, right? You know, I believe in people getting ahead based on merit, not based on a figurative gun to somebody's head. I'm going to call you a racist unless. And that bothers people that are getting power from that, right? Who are gaining power, who stand to win by building an unequal system. And it's just down the line. I mean, there's no, we can talk about how it ends bad for white people, but it also ends bad for Black people. We have to raise up to the challenge. We have to get smarter. We have to do better in school. We can't just be allowed into schools because we're Black. At the end of the day, a free market society or a capitalist society or just looking at global competition, it doesn't work. We can't pretend to know the answers when we don't, right? A society is not going to get ahead based on giving people extra credit for having darker skin. So equality, for some reason, to most people today, feels like oppression. And it's a bizarre circumstance. But what I'm fighting for and what my movement is fighting for is equality. And there's actually less of that right now in society.
I have one of my last questions for you is a thought, and it just jumped in my head, and I never had it before, but we'll see how it sounds coming out of my mouth, and maybe we can examine it a little bit. So if I talk to some of my liberal friends and I say to them, let's give the black man and the black community, let's set some standards, let's expect that they show up. And, you know, again, getting rid of making a rule that you can't discipline young black boys in junior high is not going to be good for the future of them. It's not going to fix any problems. It's simply going to get the statistics of you will lower the number of black boys expelled from classes if, in fact, you stop expelling anybody for behavior problems. But that's not obviously that's like I always sort of say it's like saying this car doesn't go fast enough. And someone goes, well, then break the glass of the speedometer, use your finger and turn the dial faster. It's like, well, that'll say 90, but we're not going any faster. But
great analogy.
So they say. But Adam, you have to understand. You have to understand Jim Crow. You have to understand the effects of Jim Crow. You have to understand the effects of slavery. How can we expect X, Y, and Z with this in the past? I wonder if, in a way, now that it's 2020 and we're quite a distance from Jim Crow and from slavery, in a weird way, it's all their horrible policies that they've enacted, all the affirmative action stuff, all the stuff we speak about, all these horrible policies that they put into place, all that never-ending rhetoric from the race hustlers in the media. This is the new lingering effect of Jim Crow and slavery. There is a reason why young black boys are having difficulty now, but it's not from Jim Crow. It's from the poison you've been feeding them over the last 50 years and all these failing horrible policies. So in fact, there is a tangible, legitimate reason, but it's not that. It's the ones you guys, it's the policies you guys implemented.
That's correct. It's their illusory policies. So they're meant to make it seem like things have progressed when they haven't progressed. They've actually regressed. All of these policies have actually led to black regression. So you can actually trace a stronger black America at the end of the 1960s than the black America today. So black America was doing better in the 1950s than black America is doing today, right? Why? Because the Democrats seized, via the Great Society Act under Lyndon Baines Johnson, complete and utter control of the black family unit, the breakdown of the family, welfare policies that were meant to help, but they just hurt because people then wanted to stay on welfare and had to basically do less to stay on welfare, to aspire to less to stay on welfare and to get that government check. Women were inspired not to marry the father of their children, which disadvantages children because they need to grow up in a two-parent home. So all of these illusory helping, but you're actually hurting policies are what we're seeing today. Affirmative action. And if you look at the concrete proof of affirmative action, and it's great to look at Clarence Thomas, when he was really trying to get in the Supreme Court for them to strike this down. And he talks about how it has harmed Black America. Thomas Sowell talks about it. They're all on academic probation. They're getting into the schools and they're flunking out. They're getting into schools and they're at the bottom of their classes. You want to know why? Because they shouldn't be in schools in the first place. Stop forcing them into schools they don't belong and stop mismatching them. Put them into schools where they actually belong, where they have a chance of being up top of their class. Because guess what? Their performance is here. You know, their performance, you can't pretend somebody knows the answer to a test. But that's what we're doing. And then they get outperformed when, you know, you're at MIT and you've got Asians that are, you know, doing math in ways that Americans just can't do math. And you're wondering why black Americans are flunking out. You're harming black America every step of the way by trying to help. Right. You want to help. Let us do the work. Stay away from this. Stop talking about it. Let us fix this. Stop giving us excuses. That's the methodology behind how you help every person stop giving them excuses and tell them that they have to do the work and they have to figure it out. That's called equality.
Very well stated. My last thought is, when you're talking about your grandfather and your grandmother basically saying, this is how it works. You get up early. You go to work. You work in the yard. You read the Bible. You take care of yourself. You present yourself. Like, unfortunately, it is, I always use this analogy. My audience is tired of hearing it, but you're going to hear it. I always say diet and exercise. Like, the reality for life is, if you'd like to lose weight and you'd like to get in shape, it's diet and exercise, and it's boring as shit, and it's old as sand, and everyone knows it in the back of their head, but no one wants to do it, and there's fads, and there's trainers, and there's Weight Watchers, and there's fudge brownies that are low carb and high protein, but it all just comes down to what your grandfather said, diet and exercise. That's it. And it's universal. Just like diet and exercise will work the same on a white body as a black body as a Hispanic body, the kind of life that your grandfather preached and led by example is really the only thing that works. It is it. There's nothing from the state. There's no ordinance that can be passed. There's just nothing that can be done from the outside in. It's all from the inside out. It's all about the family, the hard work, the getting up early, the honest day's work for the honest day's pay, the boringest, tritest, oldest stuff, the stuff the left hates because it feels like Ozzie and Harriet to them. It feels they don't like the old stuff. Everything's got to be, we have to reimagine everything. We have to reimagine the family. We have to reimagine policing. We have to reimagine education. We have to reimagine everything. The problem is it's like reimagining diet and exercise. There is no substitute. That is it. If everyone would implement this, every problem would go away immediately. And a politician can't get elected on it. Al Sharpton's not going to be able to hammer checks by talking this way. But yet, it's all that'll ever work.
I totally agree. That's the magic formula.
Well, congratulations on your pregnancy, by the way.
Thank you.
I heard about that, but I don't know. In a weird way, everyone is always loves that, and I'm always like, I want to talk policy.
Yeah. No worries.
But I hope to see you next time you're in Los Angeles doing something for PragerU.
Absolutely.
And always a pleasure, and Godspeed. And I mean it, and I'm an atheist, and I'm saying Godspeed to you, Candace Owens.
That's good.
Blackout is the name of the book, How Black America Can Make Its Second Escape from the Democratic Plantation, available now on Amazon. And you can also check out her show, The Candace Owens Show, on PragerU.com. And also you can take a look at the PragerU YouTube channel as well. Candace, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'll see you soon.
I hope so. All right, last but not least, we got Geico. Right now, Geico's offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies. That's 15% on top of the money Geico could already be saving you. So what are you waiting for? I say you don't wait any longer. You get going with Geico. Never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com. To learn more, that is geico.com. All right, Salt Lake City coming up, Wise Guys, this weekend. Couple of shows there, Friday and Saturday. And then also late shows are sold out. Then matinee show as well with Garrigus. And Koechner's going to be on and all sorts of fun. You go to adamcarolla.com for all the live shows. Jay Moore, crazy ass. Jay Moore is dragging his crazy ass in here tomorrow. We're going to do some shows with him. And until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Candace Owens and Bald and Gina and Jeff saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Big thanks to Bet Online. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. then pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. All the links are at adamcarolla.com.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.